You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, Andre Linde on the detection of primordial gravitational waves.
What we have right now is magically blown up quantum fluctuations of gravitational field stretched over the whole sky and put it for all of us to enjoy.
While cosmologist João Magalhães provides his own alternative take on the BICEP2 announcement.
So whatever had been seen, people would come out and be hysterical about the evidence for inflation, which means this is obviously evidence against inflation.
And we investigate the origins of time and space, asking if thermodynamics, the science of heat, can help us understand gravity and dark energy.
And lo and behold, your standard Einstein's equation can come from a completely thermodynamical variational principle.
Or, if perhaps space and time are stitched together by quantum entanglement.
It's actually part of a quantum computer. It's storing the information about your higher dimensional world using this quantum entanglement.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Brendan, I've missed you. We haven't put together a podcast in a while.
No, that's because we got a I didn't read the new edition yet. No, that's because we got addicted. It's funny because it's true. No, that's because we got addicted to the game 2048 and we're too distracted to record another edition. No, wait. I mean, that's because we wanted to give you listeners some time to catch up with the podcast special editions with audio, video, and slides from FQXI's latest international conference that was held in Puerto Rico earlier this year. If you haven't already, please visit www.fqxi.org/community for more from that meeting. There was so much great stuff at the meeting that we're still putting up new material. So, yes, we took a bit of a break from the regular FQXI podcast. It's a good thing there hasn't been any major physics news over the past month or so for us to cover.
No big news. Nothing that grabbed international headlines and featured prominent FQXI members, for instance. Such as the announcement in March that astronomers working on the BICEP2 experiment had detected the first signs of primordial gravitational waves?
What? Primordial gravitational waves have been detected? And that was announced in March? Nobody tells me anything. But that's huge.
If the finding stands up, then yes, it is. The astronomers discovered evidence of what are known as B modes in the relic radiation of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background. These B modes are a particular type of twisty pattern in the polarization of photons and are thought to be the signature of the passage of gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time that were generated in the universe's earliest moments.
Oh, B modes. I thought they were just listening to me hosting the FQXI podcast.
Oh, very nice.
I could think of a couple of FQXI members who would have been pleased to hear that news. Primordial gravitational waves are said to be the smoking gun of inflation. The idea developed by FQXI's Alan Guth and Andre Linde and others that says that the early universe went through a massive growth spurt, expanding faster than the speed of light, soon after the Big Bang. If only we could chat to one of them and ask them what the implications of this new result are for our understanding of physics.
Well, you're in luck, Brendan, because funnily enough, I did speak with Andre Linde earlier.
What a coincidence! It's like I'm psychic. Or like I'm reading this off a script.
Indeed. Anyway, as I say, earlier I spoke with Andre Linde, one of the founders of inflation theory, now at Stanford University, about what the BICEP2 announcement means for inflation, string theory, the idea we live in the multiverse, and quantum gravity. I should say, congratulations, this must be a happy time for you. Because, of course, in March, Astronomers working with the BICEP 2 telescope, located in the South Pole, announced to great global fanfare that they had detected primordial gravitational waves for the first time. This has been hailed as the first direct evidence for the theory of inflation, a theory that originated with you and with FQXI member Alan Guth, which suggests that the very early universe went through a period of rapid, faster-than-light expansion. So, can you tell us how that feels?
Oh, well, if anybody brings to you wonderful news, why won't you be excited? Even when the news were brought to me, always I was thinking, if true, okay? So this state of if true, it may continue for quite a while because this experiment is to be verified, is to be confirmed. We all hope that it will stay the test of time. On the other hand, I would not quite agree that this is the only direct evidence for inflation because I believe there are many. If for whatever reason it is not a correct result, will I be crying? Well, no, not really. I will be a bit disappointed, but I will not change anything in the schedule of my work. But if this result is real, then it gives us quite a lot of additional handles of what inflation is. And irrespectively of inflation, if correct, this result would be one of the first important evidence in favor of quantum gravity at work.
When this announcement was made, you know, it was all over the news. It grabbed, you know, the top headlines everywhere. Were you surprised by that, actually, that the public is so excited about this? Was that sort of gratifying?
Oh, I think a part of it goes, here we're talking about the birth of the universe, one trillions of a trillions of a trillions of a second after the Big Bang. So it just, well, calls everyone's attention. There's something going about the origin of all of us. That's why it's so emotionally important, I guess.
So let's talk about exactly what it was that was detected. So gravitational waves are a sort of a ripple in the fabric of space-time itself, and they were predicted to exist by Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. And, you know, they can be created by a cataclysmic event such as two black holes colliding. But in this case in particular, astronomers were looking at the cosmic microwave background, the bath of radiation that's been left over by the Big Bang. And they were looking for imprints in the cosmic microwave background. So like water waves kind of washing over the beach can leave imprints in the sand. You know, these astronomers were hoping to find an imprint of what's known as primordial gravitational waves that were generated in the very early universe, left on the cosmic microwave background itself. And they detected a particular pattern in the polarization of light in the cosmic microwave background that leads them to conclude that they have seen this imprint of primordial gravitational waves. So can you tell us a little bit more about what exactly a primordial gravitational wave is and what's its relationship to inflation? Why is it considered to be evidence for inflation?
Okay. Then I must first say a few words about what inflation is. So inflation is exponential expansion of the universe at the very first milliseconds of its existence. And every possible non-uniformity of the universe was stretched so far that the universe becomes normal, uniform, homogeneous, which is great. But then we still need to produce galaxies. And these galaxies, surprisingly, have been produced, according to the theory, have been produced from quantum fluctuations, which existed at the first trillions of a trillions of a trillions of a second after the Big Bang, which looks like science fiction, but apparently it is not, because there are some imprints of this primordial expansion of the universe on cosmic microwave ground radiation. And that is because quantum fluctuations produced at that time made some parts of the sky a little bit warmer and some parts of the sky a little bit colder, just a little bit, just 1/100,000 of its normal temperature. But this is something which experiments have discovered long, long time ago. And now they studied, well, experimentalists studied a much more sophisticated imprint on this cosmic microwave ground radiation, imprint of gravitational waves which have been produced during inflation. So this is imprint of the kind which is very, very difficult to make by any other tools. That is why it was so important to register it, assuming that it indeed has this cosmological origin, which is something which people are going to debate for quite a while yet.
I must pick you up on something else that you said as you were talking earlier. You talked about the implications for quantum gravity.
Actually, the regime where these gravitational waves were produced was exactly the regime which directly tested quantum gravity. Gravitational waves which have been produced there, they are produced because of quantum gravity effects. In essence, what happens is that in the early universe, quanta of gravitational field have been produced. And these quanta after that, they were stretched by rapid expansion, so their wavelengths have grown up, and now we see imprints of these quanta in polarization of cosmic microwave background radiation. So if you wish, what we have right now is magically blown up quantum fluctuations of gravitational field, stretch it over the whole sky and put it for all of us to enjoy. So that is a very, very direct evidence in favor of our understanding of quantum gravity. So we are testing general relativity and quantum gravity at these huge energies.
You know, one of the things about inflation is that it's sort of a large kind of umbrella term, and there are lots of different possibilities or different models that could explain how inflation occurred. Do these experimental results help us narrow down, perhaps, the correct model of inflation in some way?
Well, we should then start studying from back and past, because maybe 99% of the versions of inflationary theory which have been produced in the past, they have been already disproved. So let me check first what happened before and where we're now and what this new data tell us.
Mm-hmm.
The first model which had this name was invented by Alan Guth back in 1980. This was called old inflation. It was based on the exponential expansion in the false vacuum state. It was based also on assumption that our universe originally was hot, and then it supercooled, and after that we had a stage of inflation. And in 83, I suggested a version which I called chaotic inflation, and it was much, much simpler. No need for thermal initial conditions in the universe. In fact, they made everything more complicated. And this scenario was extremely simple, but psychologically very difficult to accept, because the hot Big Bang was not necessary there. I think that it is so deeply ingrained in our psyche that it is still psychologically difficult for people to say that Big Bang does not mean necessarily high temperature in the beginning, that everybody thinks that our universe was born like a terrorist explosion, very, very hot. But apparently it is actually makes our construction of inflationary theories more difficult rather than easier. It seems that this kind of model right now is favored both by Planck data and by data by many other previous experiments, but especially by BICEP2 data.
So let's talk about the multiverse. Are we taking this as good news for the multiverse?
Well,
or for people who love the multiverse, I guess, or who want a multiverse to exist.
Yeah, it's like saying that there is no bad publicity. Every publicity is good for something. Any support to the idea of inflation is good for multiverse in the following sense. If you are just talking about the idea of a multiverse in general, we're talking about different mathematical constructs, different realities, different maybe universes, but this is a little bit too abstract. It is general, it is powerful, it's very, very important, but it's a little bit too abstract to help others. Like, think about different mathematical realities. It's a little bit further away from your heart. It is better if you know something simpler than that. And the simpler image would be, our Earth is covered by ocean and by dry land. This dry land is divided into different countries with different laws and stuff. Now imagine that you have this Earth. This is like one single body, but you just made it billions of billions of billions times larger. Then each country would be so immense that you will never travel to any other countries. Then you look at it and say, okay, I live in a country where they speak Chinese, and I go to a different part of the country and they all speak Chinese. And I will then conclude that all our Earth is, well, populated by people who only speak Chinese. That is until I travel to other place. But if the size of the country is exponentially large, I will never travel to any other place. Then I will start imagining that there must be some principle of nature that all people must speak Chinese because this is the only language which exists in nature. So what inflation tells us, that if you take a universe and it may be from the very beginning consistent from different countries, if you wish, then when you explode it exponentially, then these countries are preserved, but they become so large that laws of nature will be realized in a totally different way in these different countries. But this is possible only if there is a mechanism which explodes our universe, which makes it huge. And the only mechanism which we know which does it, it's inflation. So every argument in favor of inflation opens further, more widely, the doors towards the thinking about the multiverse.
Well, now, you've mentioned string theory, and I've heard some conflicting opinions about what this result means for string theory. And I guess, in particular, people were a little bit surprised when this result came back. Not only that the astronomers had managed to detect this signal, but kind of the dramatic size of the signal was perhaps something that, you know, they weren't predicting based on earlier results that came from the Planck data.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have sort of been looking at that and trying to look at the size of the signal and compare it to predictions from different kinds of models. And I've heard some people saying, well, you know, this doesn't bode well for the predictions that were made by various string theory models. But then I've heard other people come in and say, well, yes, but it's fine for other ones. So can you sort of clear up a little bit, I guess, about, first of all, the tension with the Planck data, if you see that there is tension there, and, you know, what it means for string theory?
I guess some of the people who are saying some, negative stuff about string theory with respect to this data may even base it on my own talk, which was given at MIT next day after the announcement. I gave their talk and I have shown the table of different results from the recent review on string theory inflation. And inside this table, there were 10 different lines, and all of them predicted this amplitude of gravitational waves at the level 10 minus 10. Meanwhile, the result right now, if correct, it is approximately 0.2. So this is a big disagreement. But not everybody noticed that there is some particular model where I had a smiley face near it, which is a model proposed by Eva Silverstein, a professor of physics at Stanford University, together with several collaborators, which predict this amplitude of this R, which is a ratio of tensor to scalar perturbations in inflation, approximately about 0.1. And it's absolutely possible, I'm sure, to have different versions of string theory which predict the amplitude of the signal of this type. The fact that one of the theories which I like, even before all of these experiments, I liked Eva's model much more than many others. So right now, these models is singled out by experimental data, and that's great.
And I guess the reason that I was sort of asking you about this was once again to ask you about the Planck results and the WMAP results, because mm-hmm. is it fair to say that they were not pointing towards, you know, the same kinds of models that BICEP2 is?
They were pointing out to different classes of models. So Planck results, Planck data disfavored large gravitational waves. BICEP data favored the models which predict large amplitude of gravitational waves. Which one is right? And that's very hard for me to say because I am not an observer. I know that BICEP data are more surgically correct. They are more precise in what they are measuring. They study, however, only a small fraction of the sky. And you can always find some surprises which may inadvertently occur in some particular part of the sky. There could be something else which we do not know what it is. There is some tension between all of these results. I do hope that these BICEP results are correct, but let's just wait. One of the things which we should be waiting for are some Planck data about the polarization. Planck has its own strengths. It covers all the sky. So it would be extremely important to have data from both experiments come to peace, and we will hopefully see this coming in half a year to year.
And we have seen people kind of coming in and suggesting that maybe we could be misinterpreting effects from, you know, galactic contamination or something like that. So I guess there is an element of waiting and seeing what happens next.
My feeling is that there is a good chance that the signal which they have found is real. Well, I'm practically sure that the signal is real. The interpretation of it, the one which they suggested, seemed to be most natural and most convincing. But in order to totally, absolutely exclude any other interpretations of their data, this is something about which people would need to think and to discuss and to debate and suggest their own alternatives to this interpretation. But this, I hope, within half a year or so, a year, we'll have a more clear picture of.
Thank you very much. That was absolutely wonderful.
Okay, let's hope that it all stands well. And it will be still interesting at the time when you put it on the web.
I'll try and put it up next week.
Oh, then next week, next week, probably, yes.
Right. Hopefully we won't have any dramatic retractions by then.
Yeah, but, you know, just earlier there was this paper by some people who say there are magnetic loops in the sky, and this BICEP was just on the way of one of these magnetic loops. And then it's discussed right now in different places on the web. So there will be lots and lots of interesting stuff and suggestions like that before we have a full clarity of everything.
Well, that's how it should be, I guess. I mean, you know,
for
something like this to stand up, you want to throw everything you can at it and see if it still sticks. And if it does, then you've got a really solid result.
So, yeah.
Well, congratulations again and have a good day.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Andre Linde chatting with Zia. Just like Andre emphasized there, it's worth remembering that it's still early days since that announcement was made.
Yes, there's a lot of excitement about the BICEP2 result amongst cosmologists, but there's also some caution as people wait to see what other independent data, such as that collected by the Planck telescope, will show. I recently spoke with João Magejo, a cosmologist at Imperial College London, who is, shall we say, ultra-skeptical about the finding. Here's what he had to say.
My major concern at the moment is that the BICEP results might really be galactic contamination, in which case we're making a huge fuss about nothing. And just that we have this thing in front of us. We are inside the galaxy. We can't help it. And we're making observations which are contaminated by the galaxy. And it's very difficult to subtract this junk. They are subtracting it carefully. I'm not saying they're making a mistake deliberately or even just, you know, from carelessness. But these things could really change. Also, these results could be seen as inconsistent with Planck, for example. I wouldn't say they have to be, but you have to bend backwards to make the two things fit. So what will be interesting is in the next few months to see what the Planck team has got to say about this. And until we sort that out, I think it's premature to announce that this is actually gravity waves.
And so when you talk about this tension with the Planck results, you know, what exactly are you referring to?
Well, Planck data is temperature data. All it is observe the temperature of the radiation, the cosmic radiation, whereas BICEP data is about polarization. And Planck will have a polarization data set coming through in the next few months, hopefully. On the other hand, there are implications about gravity waves already from the temperature data set in Planck. And given, again, being really minimalistic about the model, given what Bicep 2 saw, Planck should have seen it as well in the temperature already. And in fact, one of the implications of the Planck results was that if gravity waves were present, they would have to be at a very low level, in fact, lower than what has been seen. So when I say people have to bend backwards, I mean, of course, it's very contrived. Maybe the universe is very contrived. And maybe this is what this tension is telling us. But I think we should wait and see the polarization data from Planck before we start getting very, very worried about it.
So I guess, you know, taking it at face value, it is an exciting result. And well, it's been said that it's kind of a confirmation or even a verification of inflation. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I think what has happened is just complete proven evidence of the basic scientific dishonesty of inflation. Because Planck results said gravity waves exist at a very low value, this was paraded as evidence for inflation. Now they're very high, there's a lot of gravity waves, this is paraded as evidence for inflation. Any observation and you'd say it's evidence for inflation. Now we have a very poignant demonstration of that. So whatever had been seen, people would come out and be hysterical about the evidence for inflation, which means this is obviously evidence against inflation altogether. And this is my point of view on this matter.
Okay, that's quite a controversial point of view, or is it? Or are lots of people sort of thinking that way?
This is a sociological statement saying this is controversial. And if you just abstract from all the hype and all the sociology, the evidence for inflation has to be degraded from the fact that there are so many models. If you cannot disprove inflation, you cannot prove it either.
Of course, Magaggio has worked on alternatives to inflation theory. You can hear about one of those, the idea that light broke its own speed limit by traveling faster in the early universe, in our podcast episode from September 2012.
Some simple versions of Magaggio's varying speed of light model would be ruled out by the current Bicep 2 results, as would other popular alternative models to inflation, such as the cyclic universe model proposed by Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok, which states that the universe went through a cycle of big bangs and big crunches. But other alternatives could survive, including string gas cosmology, which investigates the evolution of the very early universe in terms of string theory. Another alternative model, which is compatible with the discovery of gravitational waves, and which Magaggio has also had a hand in developing, is charmingly dubbed the rainbow gravity model. This suggests that gravity splits light like a prism, and light's constituent colours travel along different paths in space-time. Here's Magaggio again.
So there's a bunch of models, alternative models, which should be ruled out by the Bicep 2 result, and you should state this very clearly. In addition, there are alternative models to inflation, which do predict gravity waves. So for example, string gas cosmology predicts gravity waves and predicts very specific things about gravity waves, not just that they exist. If you take varying speed of light theories based on what we call rainbow gravity, the idea that different colors move at different speeds, then Bicep result just means that the speed of gravity at very high energies is about 40 times the speed of light, and you can actually adjust that to predict those values or the observed values. So it's a wait and see, and I think it's great that these alternative theories are so specific about what they predict, because it means if the results really survive scrutiny, then these theories are dead. If they don't, well, they're alive, and much better than inflation, I should think.
Thank you to João Magaggio there for giving us an alternative take on the Bicep 2 announcement.
If you want to know more about some of the more technical implications for our understanding of the early universe due to the Bicep 2 result, and the kinds of models that it favors and rules out, then you can listen to an extended version of the interview with Linde on the website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. We're also linking to articles about the possibility that the Bicep 2 signal isn't actually from primordial gravitational waves, but from other sources, such as radio loops, radio emission possibly from ancient supernovae. And there's a bit more about gravity rainbow theories too.
Also on the podcast page, there's a lovely video showing Linde's reaction when he first hears news about the discovery.
And while you're at the community page, don't forget to check in with this year's essay contest. which asks how humanity should steer the future.
So how's it going, Brendan?
Well, we've just passed the deadline for entries, and almost all of them are now online to read. And I have to say, in my opinion, this might be the best class of entries we've ever had for an essay contest. In terms of the average quality and the number of really good, really interesting essays. We've got all sorts of entries, people proposing new ideas for what we should do as a species, new technologies we could develop. We've got fictional accounts of the future. We have people who took the question, how should we steer, in the sense of whatever the direction we're going is, how could we actually get everyone to work together to go in that direction? And some people asked, should we even try to steer?
Oh, I like that, sort of questioning the question itself. But the contest is still open for voting until the end of May. So please drop by and rate the essays and take part in the discussion.
You know what I love about these essay contests is that they inspire people to bring together different branches of physics to address a problem and invite you to look at something in a totally new way.
Which brings us nicely to a cosmologist I had the pleasure of meeting in March, Tanu Padmanabhan of the Inter-University Centre for Astronomy and Astrophysics in Pune, India, gave talks at Cambridge University and at Imperial College London, outlining a very different way of thinking about gravity.
Usually, we describe gravity at a cosmic level using Einstein's general theory of relativity, which tells us that space and time are woven together to form a four-dimensional fabric. Massive objects bend and warp this fabric. Our sun, for instance, would deform space-time, something like a bowling ball on a rubber sheet, causing the planets in our solar system to fall towards it. That's usually how we explain the origin of gravity.
Padmanabhan, however, has been approaching gravity by thinking about thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics, that's the science of heat flow. How can that be connected to gravity?
Well, thermodynamics provides a statistical description averaged over many molecules. So, for instance, the temperature of a gas is a measure of the average motion of its molecules. And Padmanabhan and his colleagues have shown that it's possible to derive Einstein's equations by taking a similar attitude to the nature of gravity. When I caught up with him at Imperial, he explained to me just how this program works and how his team are using it to explain the origin of dark energy, the mysterious entity that seems to be causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate.
I am Tanu Padmanabhan. I am a dean at Inter University Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics at Pune, India.
You've been thinking about gravity in a slightly unconventional way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and a number of other independent researchers, but it's still a minority way of thinking about gravity. So, before you explain the kind of different way of looking at things, can you explain the conventional way about thinking about gravity in terms of general relativity and Einstein's equations?
Yeah. In the standard picture, it is very easy. You think of gravity as manifestation of space-time curvature. So the space is not flat, it is curved like a surface of a sphere or what you have. And then we have some field equations which determines this gravitational field. So if you tell me how much matter is there in some place, I'll be able to tell you how that matter curves the space-time. And from that, I can figure out how gravity acts on everything else.
You're thinking about things in terms of not just taking the space-time fabric as kind of a fundamental component of the universe, but trying to think of space and time emerging from something else, some kind of atoms of space-time. Why think about it in that way? Why not just accept it the way it is?
So the first thing is that if you look at the conventional general relativity, there are several features which we don't understand. It turns out that if you take the conventional general relativity very seriously and you look at physical phenomena there, again and again, you are hit by the fact that there can be observers who cannot see part of the space-time. The classic example is a black hole from the inside of which you cannot see signals, but black hole is just a special case. There are a whole lot of cases where the light surfaces, that is the surfaces at which light is propagating, will block information from the observer. When that happens, it is accepted fact that you can attribute a temperature and entropy to these surfaces. So it looks very strange that gravity, out of all other interactions, have a thermodynamic description.
So let me just get this straight. When we say that we're talking about a thermodynamical framework, we're really talking about, you know, the sort of things that we learn in school when we're talking about gases and heat.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we are talking about. So the idea is that suppose you have told some 17th century physicist that you have matter, and he would have written down equations for gaseous matter or solid matter which is vibrating as an elastic solid. And if you have told him that the matter is made of tiny, tiny molecules, he would have probably laughed at you. Okay. And in fact, Boltzmann was not taken very seriously during his lifetime. And this is exactly what Boltzmann said. He said that if a system has energy and it has temperature, then there must be degrees of freedom, microscopic degrees of freedom, which holds this energy in terms of the microscopic motions. That is exactly what is happening in space-time. Space-time has temperature, space-time has energy. Therefore, space-time should have microscopic degrees of freedom, which keeps this energy in it, just like a solid does or a gas does. Then, once you have that part, then rest of the thermodynamics follows. And you can do anything which you do with thermodynamics. So this is what motivated many of us to sort of look at it more seriously. Then we found that even in classical gravity, the standard Einstein gravity, several things which are unclear becomes much clearer when you look at it from a thermodynamic language. For example, the field equations themselves has a completely thermodynamic interpretation. You don't have to think in terms of a curvature being evolving, etc., etc. You can think of in terms of surface degrees of freedom and bulk degrees of freedom, and how the difference between these two drives the heating of the space-time.
So you gave the example there of a black hole, and I guess when you're associating it with thermodynamics, I'm thinking of things like the results in the 1970s where Stephen Hawking discovered that black holes can radiate, mm-hmm. Hawking radiation as it's called, kind of thermal energy. And I guess you're saying here, it's not just thinking about sort of the event horizon around black holes, but there are other kind of horizons maybe where we can't see what's on the other side of the horizon, perhaps because of distance. Okay.
It is actually a very general phenomenon. This result which you are quoting came somewhere around 1974-75, and two gentlemen, Paul Davies and Bill Andrew, proved a result which in my mind is much more general. What they showed was that in any space-time, or rather their result can be reinterpreted as saying that in any space-time, there exists certain class of observers, and these observers will not access regions of space-time, and they will think of the space-time as hot. So this result is much, much more general than just the kind of black hole thermodynamics which one thinks of.
You know, I guess this is something that is just kind of strange, like you say, that gravity and thermodynamics can be related. But, you know, where do we go with that in terms of thinking about the origins of space and time, or the atoms of space and time, or, you know, deriving equations to describe what happens with gravity?
Okay. So deriving equations part is easy. So let me start with that. What happens is that once you have temperature and entropy, and you understand that you want to have a thermodynamic description, the entire framework of thermodynamics is there to aid you. So all that you have to do, I did the most natural thing, namely to look at the heat content in some region of space and say that this heat content should be maximized. It is somewhat like maximizing the entropy. So thermodynamics tells you what to do. You just repeat it. And lo and behold, this leads to a nicer version of Einstein's equation. First of all, it gives you Einstein's equation, which itself is remarkable, which tells you that your standard Einstein's equation can come from a completely thermodynamical variational principle. And what is more remarkable is that if you go back again to, say, 17th century or 18th century physicists, they knew how to measure the total number of degrees of freedom in a gas. It is called Avogadro's number. But they had no clue what they are measuring. So in the same sort of way, you can use Einstein's equation to measure what is the total amount of degrees of freedom which is there in some region. And you can actually calculate that. This we have done. And that turns out to be essentially you take the area and cut it into small Planck area bits, and every bit counts as one.
You know, I guess this brings us to the question of what are the molecules of space-time?
Yes. So that we have not yet answered. So it is somewhat like, again, asking an 18th century physicist what the atoms are made of. Many of us are working on that, and we have some ideas as to what the microscopic degrees of freedom is probably going to be. And there are two ways of looking at this question. One way of looking at it is, whatever it is, it could be, say, string theory, if it is correct, then the strings are the fundamental constituents of what space-time is built out of. And what we need to do is to come up with a thermodynamic description of these strings, which matches with what we are doing. So what we are doing is something like a top-down approach in length scales, and there is a bottom-up approach in the length scales, and these two has to match at some stage. That is one way of doing it. And we have some ideas as to how to proceed further. But the remarkable thing is that even without knowing what it actually is, you can say very non-trivial things about it. This is exactly what 17th and 18th century physicists did. They did not know what is the molecular constitution of matter, but they could very well describe vibration of elastic solids or gas dynamics of ideal gases without any problem. So it has a tremendous amount of power in this approach. And as I said, we have an approach in which you can actually try to understand why the cosmological constant has the value it has from this approach.
So this is related to the problem of dark energy. So in the late 1990s, astronomers realized that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, but exactly why it's doing so is a mystery. They attribute this now to the presence of something called dark energy. And many cosmologists think that one of the best candidate explanations for dark energy is something called the cosmological constant, which is a measure of the intrinsic energy of space, which could be pushing it apart and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. So yes, so please explain, how do you solve the problem of the cosmological constant? How, you know, people have struggled to explain why it's so small. So how does this come out of your work?
Okay, so there are two ingredients to this. The first point is that the way people usually think about cosmological constant is some kind of a problem with a constant. But in this approach, it resurfaces as a problem with gravity, so to speak. That the gravity should not care about the zero level of the energy. If you shift the energy up or down, gravitational equation should not change. It turns out that the emergent gravity paradigm, where you think of it as thermodynamic, has this naturally built into it. I emphasize that it was not sort of designed for it. So it is an extra bonus, and that I think is very important, that this theory naturally ignores the shifting of the energy levels. Second, it also tells you to think about space-time evolution in terms of degrees of freedom on a surface and on a bulk. At a very fundamental level, the degrees of freedom which is on a Planck length sphere is actually 4 pi, because it comes from the 4 pi r square divided by r square being 4 pi. And this remains as a conserved quantity as the universe expands. So using this number 4 pi in and putting it into the equations, it turns out that you can actually explain the observed value of the cosmological constant. And any change in this due to shifting of the energy levels of matter is completely ignored in the formalism. So as a result of which, you have both the ingredients which you need for solving the cosmological constant problem.
Thank you to Tanu Padmanabhan. There's an extended version of that interview on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. You'll also find a link to an article that Zia wrote for Nature about the origins of space and time, featuring his research and the work of many others.
For that Nature article, I also chatted with a physicist called Mark Van Ramsdonk at the University of British Columbia, who has also been thinking deeply about the origins of space and time, but from a different angle.
That's right. Van Ramsdonk is working on the idea that the most fundamental constituents of reality are not space and time, but that space and time themselves depend on quantum entanglement, the spooky property that can link two or more quantum particles in the lab so that they start to act like one joint entity. Van Ramsdonk spoke with reporter Karin Pikama and told her more about his quantum quest for the ultimate glue binding reality together.
Decades of research have shown that quantum theory explains the nature and behavior of particles on atomic and subatomic levels with exquisite precision. However, even Einstein, who came up with some of the foundational research on which quantum mechanics is based, was acutely aware that the mathematics underpinning the theory could not be extended to explain the motion of much larger objects, such as stars and planets, which are governed by gravity. Since then, physicists have struggled to come up with a single theory of quantum gravity that encompasses the physics of both the very small and the extremely large. Mark van Ramsdonk, a professor of physics at the University of British Columbia in Canada, argues that the most fundamental component of a theory of quantum gravity may turn out to be entanglement. This is a spooky quantum property that famously led Einstein to doubt whether quantum theory could provide a complete description of the universe, because it seems to allow far-flung objects to communicate faster than the speed of light. Despite Einstein's misgivings, entanglement has now been demonstrated in the lab, and van Ramsdonk proposes that entanglement may be the glue that holds space-time itself together. Via Skype, van Ramsdonk told me about his ideas. To set the scene, he started by explaining why quantum theory is currently not yet capable of explaining all the laws that govern nature and the universe.
In the last century, people were successful in taking the existing theory of electricity and magnetism, which really explains most of the physics that we observe, and basically building in the rules of quantum mechanics. So they combine these two things to a theory called quantum electrodynamics. And that it was difficult to do, but it gave us a theory that works beautifully. There's certain predictions that we can make theoretically with that theory that work to 8 decimal places. You can predict a number, and then you can go out and do an experiment and measure the same thing, and everything agrees. So that quantum mechanical theory now applies to 3 of our standard 4 forces of nature. But of course, there's this other force, which is gravity. And so the situation there is that we have a theory, general relativity, that Einstein came up with that works extremely well to explain essentially all of the gravitational phenomena that we observe. And of course, most of these phenomena are at large scales, solar system distances or scales of the whole observable universe. And so we would think, well, that's a situation where we wouldn't really need quantum mechanics at all. But fundamentally, we think that the rules of quantum mechanics should apply to everything. And we can imagine certain situations where it would, in fact, be important to have a quantum mechanical theory of gravity. For example, just at the very beginning of the universe, where the density in the universe was so high, that would be a place where we just can't completely understand using Einstein's theory.
But applying the rules of quantum mechanics on a galactic scale has not been straightforward. According to Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity, matter curves the space-time that everything is living in, causing bodies to move. So what sets gravity apart from the 3 other forces of the standard model, the weak, strong, and electromagnetic forces, is that it is a manifestation of this moving space-time. However, how the mathematics of one of the main principles of quantum mechanics would apply in a dynamic world governed by gravity is not clear. According to quantum mechanics, for instance, particles can be in 2 different places at the same time. This is known as the principle of superposition. But what happens if space-time itself is quantum in nature? Van Ramsdonk sets out the problem.
If I have some physical situation where the geometry of the universe is not any definite thing, it's just difficult to think of the mathematics. If you want to have things moving around in the universe, the usual ways that we do physics, you just assume that there's some fixed space in which things are moving around. But now, according to quantum mechanics, if that applies to gravity, then not only do these things moving around not necessarily have definite locations, but the space itself could be in some state where there's no definite geometry. So it's fundamentally a little bit more difficult. And in detail, people have just tried the simplest ways of incorporating the rules of quantum mechanics into Einstein's theory and trying to apply those rules. And it just hasn't worked out very well. So that's in some sense where string theory came in.
String theory is one of the most developed candidate theories for quantum gravity. It posits that particles are actually composed of tiny vibrating threads of energy. While some physicists were searching for a mathematical solution to the problem, others were using string theory to address questions about the forces at play between quarks. And in doing this, their work incidentally provided clues that have helped in the search for a solution to the mathematical conundrum of quantum gravity.
So they came up with this mathematical theory where you start with what are essentially little microscopic rubber bands. They're one kind of one-dimensional objects that can stretch out and vibrate. And what they did was apply the rules of quantum mechanics to that system. And somehow, miraculously, when all was said and done, that theory of these quantum rubber bands had gravitational interactions in it automatically.
But string theory only gave a set of rules that allowed the researchers to do certain calculations where quantum gravitational effects were important. However, there were many questions that they were not capable of answering using just these rules. This all changed in 1998 when Juan Maldacena, now at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton, proposed an important hypothesis.
What Maldacena did is to argue that for certain examples of string theory, let's say we're trying to describe our four-dimensional universe, three space and time, he showed that that complicated theory that we didn't even completely understand was actually equivalent mathematically to a much simpler theory. And the simpler theory is a theory that lives in a lower number of dimensions, first of all. But most importantly, it's a theory that doesn't have any gravity in it. It's kind of like the theories that we came up with when we combined electromagnetism with quantum mechanics. And so we basically could now understand this equivalent theory using physics that we knew very well. It's a funny thing, if it's true, it says that you could have any sort of state of this lower dimensional system. And then there should be this dictionary that says, well, that maps on to some kind of geometry of space-time, possibly with some things in it. And then if you understood, say, the physics of this simpler system and how things evolved there, and you understood this mapping, you could figure out what was going on in the gravity system.
Maldacena's theory has given other physicists direction, and there are numerous papers and experiments agreeing with the basic premise. But despite the apparent success of this theory, it is still unclear exactly how information in the lower dimensions translates into information about gravity theory. Van Ramsdonk explains it thus.
If you're sitting in front of your computer playing some three-dimensional video game, there's this universe that you're moving through and lots of things are happening in that universe. And it seems pretty real, but of course, fundamentally, all of the information about what's happening in your video game world is stored somewhere in your computer. So there's this memory card in your computer somewhere. The memory card is like the two-dimensional system where every state of that system would correspond to the higher dimensional world. So the question now of translating the lower dimensional system into the higher dimensional system, it's sort of like if someone handed you this computer and said, well, here's the video game, and actually everything that you see is really stored on this memory card. It wouldn't be at all necessarily obvious how the information of the 3D world and the video game is stored in the 2D memory card.
Van Ramsdonk is currently trying to figure out how you could translate from the simpler 2D system to the more complicated gravity system set in space-time. And he thinks this coding happens via quantum entanglement. In quantum mechanics, superposition means that an object can be in several places at the same time. Van Ramsdonk explains it with a ball and a box. In quantum superposition, the ball can be inside or outside the box, and equally the box can be open or it can be closed. These states are all possible at the same time until you make a measurement. However, even in the quantum world, not every object or event need be independent. And this opens up very powerful possibilities.
So I could have a superposition of a ball in a closed box plus a ball outside of an open box. If I look, I'm either going to see the ball in the closed box or I'm going to see a ball sitting outside of an open box. And so now we would say that the ball in that state, the ball and the box are entangled. Because if I did a measurement and I found that the box was closed, I would then know definitely that the ball was in the box. So it's a state where neither part has a definite configuration, but somehow the uncertainty is somehow correlated. And when people talk about building quantum computers, it's really this idea of entanglement, the fact that you have these more general possibilities where different parts of a system could be entangled with each other that allow you to do things that no ordinary computer would do, or allow you to do things much faster than an ordinary computer would be able to do. So if we take that analogy with the computer almost literally, it would be saying that someone hands you this memory chip that they tell you is what's encoding the information about your video game. And what you realize is that while this memory chip is actually part of a quantum computer, it's storing the information about your higher dimensional world using this quantum entanglement. This is a central question that I'm focusing on, just trying to understand better how this works. So eventually the big plan is to continue trying to understand as best I can how this Maldacena correspondence works. And then try to make some of these generalizations to more realistic gravitational theories.
Physicists have only started seriously thinking about entanglement as a translation tool in the last 5 years, and yet we already understand much better how we can use it to determine quantum gravity from lower dimensional systems. Von Ramsdonk expects that in 5 to 10 years from now, we'll be able to have mathematically well-defined models that could potentially describe the Big Bang using quantum mechanics. While he points out to me that this does not mean we'll necessarily understand the universe in its entirety, he's nonetheless amazed by how much we already comprehend about it and all its matter.
I find it absolutely incredible somehow that we've progressed as far as we have. I don't understand why somehow the universe is just simple enough, or we're just smart enough somehow that we've, you know, managed over just, you know, a few hundred years really to go from not understanding much at all, just observing the world around us, to, you know, being able to make predictions about things that are happening at scales 100 trillion times smaller than we could really see with our eyes, or we can now confidently make predictions about what happened 14 billion years ago. I mean, we know basically how old our universe is. So who knows? Maybe it's possible to go all the way, or maybe there's a limit.
That was Mark Van Ramsdonk talking with Corinne Pickermer. You can also read an article about his latest FQXI-funded research on the website, www.fqxi.org/community.
And that's all for today. We shall leave you to ponder just where you came from and what it is you are actually made of.
And if you work out the answer, then email us at podcast@fqxi.org or tweet us at FQXI, because we'd love to know what the answer is.
Thank you again to Andre Linde, João Margelio, Tanu Padmanabhan, Mark Van Ramsdonk, and Karim Pickermer.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
Oh, so I should tell you, when I went to Cambridge, I met up with our members, Ian Durham and Dean Rickles, and they're big fans of the podcast. And I think they commented that you sound so mellow on the podcast. I think Dean described it as saying that it sounds like you're smoking a joint while you're speaking.
Really? Wow. No, that doesn't work. Huh.